Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.
The Global Story, with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story. Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 2nd of December, these are our main stories. Israel says it has attacked 200 targets in the Gaza Strip since the ceasefire with Hamas ended on Friday. Hamas says the attacks have killed more than 170 Palestinians. The Republican George Santos has become only the sixth person in US history to be expelled from Congress. And a senior official in Ukraine has said two attacks thousands of kilometres inside Russia were carried out by Ukrainian security services. Also in this podcast, the first woman to become a US Supreme Court justice has died.
I've always said that it's exciting and wonderful to be the first to do something, but I didn't want to be the last.
We look back at Sandra Day O'Connor's life. Israel says its warplanes have attacked 200 targets in the Gaza Strip since the collapse of the seven-day ceasefire on Friday morning. Hamas health officials say the renewed bombardment has killed more than 170 people. Both sides have accused each other of breaching the ceasefire deal. Speaking in Dubai, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken blamed Hamas for the resumption of violence.
Hamas reneged on commitments it made. In fact, even before the pause came to an end, it committed an atrocious terrorist attack in Jerusalem, killing three people, wounding others, including Americans. It began firing rockets before the pause had ended, and as I said, it reneged on the commitments it made in terms of releasing certain hostages.
Well, Israeli forces have dropped leaflets in areas around the southern city of Khan Yunis, warning people to evacuate. Earlier, Mr. Blinken said he had made it clear to Israel that it was imperative to put in place clear protections for civilians, like the leaflet drop and a safe zone map. Israel has promised to hit hard now the ceasefire has ended. Elon Levy is an Israeli government spokesman.
Having chosen to hold on to our women, Hamas will now take the mother of all thumpings. As of now, after Hamas violated the framework for a pause in the fighting, hostilities have resumed and the IDF has resumed combat against the Hamas army of terror in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli army has confirmed that at least four hostages have died while being held by Hamas in the Gaza Strip. The oldest was 85. 110 hostages have been released so far. At least 137 people are still held captive by Hamas and other militant groups in Gaza. Meanwhile, thousands of Gazans who moved from northern Gaza to the south to escape bombing now find themselves in unsafe zones again. So what are Gazans making of this? Well, Akram is a translator based in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. My colleague Anita Anand spoke to him and asked him to describe what was happening there on Friday.
Well, today was catastrophic by all the meanings of the word. Very heavy bombardment in Khan Yunis, in Rafah, in Al-Nusayrat, Al-Burej, in Gaza, three or four different places in Gaza, and two or three places in Gaza North.
We heard that this morning began with a huge leaflet drop from Israel, warning people around Khan Yunis and in the south that they might have to evacuate the areas that they'd been in. What do you know of that? And have you seen any of these leaflets?
Yes, those leaflets were airdropped, and they were outlining the different areas, inclusive Gaza middle zone, central area of Gaza. And they are prompting people to head south to the safe humanitarian area as described by those leaflets. And they were targeting four different areas in Khan Yunis, East Khan Yunis, Al-Garara area, Bani Suhaila area, Khuza'a area, and Abasan area. And people were asked to move south because the same leaflet says that this is a very dangerous battlefield, military operations field.
And some of the people, presumably, who are in these areas have already moved once from northern Gaza and now are moving again. I mean, do you know how easy logistically it is going to be for them?
Logistically, it's extremely challenging. And you should also take into consideration that some people were moving from Khan Yunis East to Khan Yunis West. And now their people are asked to move from Khan Yunis East to the Gaza Strip very south, which is Rafah area. In that particular area that is called as a humanitarian assistance area.
How concentrated is it going to be in that area if all these people move?
I don't think it's the whole thing is not about this particular area. The whole thing is about asking people of Gaza to leave towards the Egyptian border.
I mean, are you suggesting that this is some plan to actually push people into Egypt?
Yeah. Apparently, that has started in the very first day of the war. And they have been keeping the very same narrative, the very same request, and have been asking Gazans and telling Gazans that there is no way out of this misery and bombardment except by fleeing to the south. And now it seems to be that they are pushing the ones who are in the, already in the south, coming from the north, with the people who are already in the south to move towards the further south next to the Egyptian border. And I wonder why would they keep them next to the Egyptian border, but when you go back to their statements and their positions, you understand that something big is being prepared and they want the people to move into Sinai.
Well, that was Akram, a translator based in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Red Crescent says Israel has blocked all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza through the Rafah crossing until further notice. Well, for explanation and further context on this, I spoke to our correspondent Paul Adams. He's in Jerusalem. And I began by asking him if the resumption in the Israeli offensive has been on the same scale as before the recent ceasefire.
Not quite. I mean, this seems to be so far a bombardment from the air, from the sea and via artillery. In other words, we have not yet seen a resumption of Israel's ground operations in the Gaza City area. Now, that is something which I think is likely to take place pretty soon. And, you know, it's definitely the case that the bombardment that we saw today was every bit as destructive as previous bombardments, with a death toll in a region of 100 or so. So, you know, Palestinians up and down the Gaza Strip were definitely plunged back into the kind of reality that they were experiencing until about a week ago. But we are still waiting for ground operations to resume.
And Israel's efforts to request, ask, order Palestinians in Gaza to move south has resumed. But am I right that they're sending them to even more, or advising them to go to far more specific areas? Is that correct?
Yes. So what was different about today was that the leaflets included a QR code, so that if you are able with a smartphone and you have connectivity, you could download a map which divides the Gaza Strip up into hundreds of tiny little pockets. The idea being that Israel can more accurately direct people to leave certain very, very specific areas and move to adjacent safe areas. This is something clearly that the Americans have been pushing for. But at the moment, it's just causing confusion and a belief that people still are just being told to move willy-nilly. I think this is the first day that we have seen this particular innovation from the Israelis. It may be that over time it becomes rather more effective. But at the moment, it's just feeding into Palestinian fears that they are once again being told to leave with no prospect of going back to their homes.
And sorry, just to push you on the specifics of that. So in the middle of a war that's been going on for over 8 weeks, in a tiny area, you need a working phone with power and good connectivity to get to a specific place.
That's more or less the fact of it. I mean, the maps didn't even actually include anything like what sort of route you should take. I mean, this is clearly a gesture towards the Americans saying, look, we cannot see a repeat of what we saw before, with hundreds of thousands of people on the move, having to move huge distances. I mean, Gaza is small, but having to move for miles and miles and miles to get to something resembling a safe zone. So it is designed to be more specific. But at the moment, as I say, it's merely causing confusion and doubt.
Paul Adams speaking to me from Jerusalem. Let's go to the United States next. And the House of Representatives has voted to expel the Republican George Santos from Congress. He's only the sixth person in US history to be ousted from the chamber. Mr. Santos, who was only elected last November, was expelled after a slew of revelations about campaign fraud and lies about his private life. This was the moment that the Speaker, Mike Johnson, who's in charge of proceedings and also on the same political side as George Santos, announced the result.
On this vote, the yeas are 311, the nays are 114, with two recorded as present. Two-thirds voting in the affirmative, the resolution is adopted. Under Clause 5D of Rule 20, the Chair announces to the House that in light of the expulsion of the gentleman from New York, Mr. Santos, the whole number of the House is now 434.
So that is a rare moment indeed to hear. I asked our Washington correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, for more details.
The New York congressman's political career has basically ended in the same fashion that it started, I think, high drama. He's a 35-year-old who was elected in November 2023, and he has been dogged by claims that he simply can't tell the truth. So he started off his career by saying that he embodies the American dream as the son of Brazilian immigrants, but for many, it was less of a dream and more of a fantasist. So a lot of the lies he's accused of putting out there they range from the silly to the more serious, accused of lying about where he went to college, what his background was. He even said that he was a volleyball champion and he had to have two knee operations, which went true. He claimed a member of his family had died in 9/11. He claimed his two grandparents died in the Holocaust. A lot of that proved to be untrue. And then the more serious, where he is facing more than a dozen federal charges, accused of wire fraud, aggravated identity theft, conspiracy to commit offence against the US. And then on top of that, there was a House Ethics Committee report released earlier this month, which accused him of basically using campaign funds to bankroll a lavish lifestyle that included paying for Botox treatments, paying for a subscription to the adult content website OnlyFans. He denies all of this, but he has said that these lies are slanderous, that this is bullying, but this is all accumulated in today's vote, which has seen 311 members of the House kick him out. 105 of them were Republicans. That's almost a majority, bringing his political career to an end.
And just quickly, Nomia, on the balance of power, does it change the numbers at all in the House?
It does. So we know the Republicans had a slim majority anyway, so that's now dropped. So any party line votes, you know, the Republicans can only afford basically to lose five members. And also remember, his district is now up for grabs. Next year there'll be a special election, and that is a Democratic opportunity.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington, D.C. We're going to stay there because the first woman to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, has died. She was 93. A politician turned legal scholar, she was appointed to the court in 1981 by President Ronald Reagan. Justice O'Connor announced her withdrawal from public life 5 years ago after she was diagnosed with dementia. Oliver Conway looks back at her life and her legacy.
Once described as the most powerful woman in America, Sandra Day O'Connor cast the decisive vote on a host of laws affecting U.S. society. A former Republican state senator, she disappointed many on the right by reaffirming the Roe v. Wade judgment on abortion. But she sided with conservatives in the 2000 US election as the Supreme Court handed Florida and thus the presidency to George W. Bush, a judgment she later acknowledged was controversial.
I think people were very divided, as they were on the election itself. But I have to say, it is remarkable that we live under a system of a rule of law where hot button issues like that can be resolved without people fighting it out in the streets.
Born in 1930, Sandra Day O'Connor grew up on a ranch. Despite graduating third in her class at Stanford Law School, she couldn't get an interview, let alone a job as a lawyer, so began working for free in a county attorney's office.
I said, I know you don't have space, but I met your secretary and she was very nice and she has room out where her desk is. I'd be happy to put my desk there. Well, that's how I got a job. No pay, and my desk was in with his secretary's.
After a successful legal and political career in Arizona, she was asked by Ronald Reagan in 1981 to become the first woman on the Supreme Court. Worried that she might fail and mess things up for other women, she nearly said no.
I knew that it would be a totally new experience. I did not know if I could do the job well enough. I've always said that it's exciting and wonderful to be the first to do something, but I didn't want to be the last. And to take on that enormous task was a real concern to me.
Justice O'Connor earned a reputation on the court as a hard-working conservative, but on many issues like religion, gender and the death penalty, she sided with the Liberals. Critics accused her of paying too much attention to the politics of the day, but she said she took each case on its merits. After 12 years, she was joined by a second woman on the court. But when Sandra Day O'Connor stepped down in 2006, she was replaced by a man, much to her disappointment.
I really had, perhaps again naively, assumed my successor would likely be female. I just wish that our court had more women sitting on it. We are, numerically, about half the population in the country.
She withdrew from public life in 2018 after being diagnosed with dementia, saying, "As a young cowgirl from the Arizona desert, I never could have imagined that one day I would become the first woman justice on the US Supreme Court."
Oliver Conway on the life of Sandra Day O'Connor, who has died at the age of 93. And I think it's worth saying that the court on which she was the first now has four female members. Four women living with HIV in Kenya have each been awarded $20,000 in damages for being sterilised without their informed consent. It's the second time that the Kenyan High Court has determined that women have been coerced into a permanent medical procedure because of their HIV status. To protect the identities of the women, we've changed their names and had their voices recorded by actors in this report by Dorcas Wangira.
In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, Neema cries because she and her husband had not been able to have a child together. Her husband is now dead.
He wanted a child with me, but I was sterilized before I could fulfill that. When we went to the hospital, he didn't know.
Neema lives with HIV and had children from a previous relationship. But between 2005 and 2010, she and three other women living with HIV went to government-run Pumwani Maternity Hospital to give birth. It would be the last time they would conceive.
I feel so much pain because when I was in labor, I knew I was consenting to a cesarean section. I wasn't told that I was going to have a tubal ligation. I thought it was ordinary family planning. If they had explained the procedure properly to me, I wouldn't have signed that paper.
Bilateral tubal ligation, BTL, is a surgical procedure that cuts, ties, burns, clips, or removes parts of a woman's fallopian tubes to prevent pregnancy. All four women told the Kenyan High Court that they were operated on under pressure. One of them, who we named Pende, was given the reason why when she went to the same hospital to give birth.
We were being sterilized because we were living with HIV. I could only get the formula milk for my infant for as long as I could show proof that I had gone through the BTL procedure.
Pende wasn't alone in facing coercion. Other women were told that if they consented to the procedure, they wouldn't have to pay for their maternity fees. One of them, whom we named Amani, claimed that she wasn't told the full implications of undergoing BTL.
What hurt me the most is that they didn't tell me that the TL was permanent. They didn't tell me to come with my husband so that we make the decision together. It made my husband leave.
A father petitioner, who we named Furaha, told us how her entire family was impacted.
My husband asked me why I didn't tell him. He started drinking heavily until he was hit by a car and died. We had planned to have five children. These organizations really wronged me because they ruined my life and that of my family.
After 9 years of hearings, the High Court has ruled that forcing the women to have a tubal ligation was a violation of their fundamental rights. Their damages will be paid jointly by the medical charities Médecins Sans Frontières and Marie Stopes International, as well as by the state-owned Pumwani Maternity Hospital. We received this written statement from Marie Stopes International.
As a member of the global reproductive rights community, we understand the stigma that people living with HIV continue to face. We will continue to undertake rigorous training and monitoring to ensure that the highest standards are adhered to, and we will never be complacent about the care we deliver.
Dr. Hajir Elias is the project coordinator for Médecins Sans Frontières in Kenya.
MSF, we never did, and we are not doing medical sterilization in our missions in Kenya. If the patient opt to undergo bilateral tubal ligation, we normally refer them to third-party facilities to have it done there. We have been informed about the judgment, and we accepted it as the way it comes. We acknowledge the part of the responsibility, our share of the responsibility for what has happened to the women. We want to restate, as a medical organization, our commitment to the patient-informed consent process and to the patient dignity.
Pumwani Maternity Hospital were approached for comment but didn't respond. In the end, the four women see the ruling as more than just a compensation. It was an acknowledgement of what they have endured, an irreversible medical procedure that violated their basic rights.
Dorcas Wangira, reporting from Kenya. Still to come. The Bolshoi Theatre, one of Russia's most prominent cultural organisations, gets a new leader, who is also a high-profile supporter of Vladimir Putin.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.
Hi there, Global News podcast listeners. I'm Katia Adler, and I want to tell you about my new BBC podcast, The Global Story, where you can join us for an in-depth look at one big story every weekday. The Global Story helps make sense of the headlines with expert analysis from BBC journalists around the world. One global story at a time, in detail, daily. So, keep up to date with all the latest global events right here on The Global News podcast, and then join me for a closer look at a story making the headlines on The Global Story from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to The Global News podcast. Now, a senior Ukrainian official has told BBC News that the country's security services have blown up a rail line in Russia's far east. Explosions are said to have occurred first in a tunnel and then later on a bridge in the region of Buryatia, north of Mongolia. There's been no official comment from the Kremlin, but Russian media say an incident is being investigated. Our correspondent Jessica Parker reports from Kyiv.
In Russia's far east, the Baikal-Amur main line is a key artery running to the border of China. It's thousands of miles from Ukraine, but according to a senior official, the country's security services managed to engineer two explosions over 2 days this week, the first in a tunnel and the second on a bridge. Russian rail authorities have confirmed that a fire broke out on a train in a tunnel, but suggested that it had only caused slight delays. Nevertheless, Russian media report that a criminal investigation has been launched. Ukrainian sources say the operation was designed to disable a line that is sometimes used for military purposes. While the extent of the damage is unclear, Kyiv appears keen to demonstrate its ability to strike infrastructure that lies deep within Russian territory.
Jessica Parker reporting. More than 130 world leaders have reached a major agreement on the future of food and farming on the second day of the COP28 climate summit in Dubai. It's the first time the annual United Nations gathering has recognised that what people grow and eat has a significant impact on greenhouse gas emissions. The conference also heard from King Charles, who warned that the world was dreadfully far off track in tackling global warming. But he said he hoped the two-week summit would be a critical turning point. From Dubai, our climate editor Justin Rowlatt reports.
These COP conferences normally build momentum slowly, but the UAE is determined this one delivers progress from the very start. Yesterday, a fund to help poorer countries with climate disasters was created. Today, the UAE promised $30 billion to develop global climate solutions. And more than 130 countries, including China, Brazil and the UK, agreed to include food and farming, responsible for a third of all greenhouse gas emissions, in their climate change commitments. The pledge is short on detail, but big on ambition, a hallmark of this UN process. It is not enough yet to meet King Charles's prayer that this summit proves to be a critical turning point to transformational action. Urging them to be ambitious, the king asked the assembled leaders to answer this question.
With what we are witnessing, our choice now is a starker and darker one. How dangerous are we actually prepared to make our world?
And King Charles also had a warning for us all.
In 2050, our grandchildren won't be asking what we said. They will be living with the consequences of what we did or didn't do. So if we act together to safeguard our precious planet, the welfare of all our people will surely follow.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India was more upbeat. He boasted about his country's efforts to meet its climate targets and the very low average carbon emissions of India's vast population. That is partly a result of the population's low average income, as the Indian Prime Minister hinted. Over the past century, he said, a small section of humanity had indiscriminately exploited nature. All of humanity was paying the price for this, especially people living in the global south. Mr. Modi said India was keen to host the COP meeting in 2028. No doubt the UN would be delighted to have the world's third biggest emitter becoming more deeply involved in promoting climate action.
Justin Rowlatt reporting from the United Arab Emirates. Police in South Korea are investigating the death of a prominent but controversial monk who'd been in charge of an order where members were accused of drinking, gambling, and even breaking their vow of celibacy by having wives. What's thought to be the remains of the venerable Jia Song were discovered in a burnt-out dormitory at a temple belonging to his Buddhist sect. He'd left notes suggesting that he'd taken his own life. I heard more from our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow.
The venerable Jia Song went to one of his temples. He went to a dormitory and simply set himself alight, and the dormitory burnt down. And the following day, this was Thursday, his sect, his order, the Choge Order of Buddhists in South Korea, announced that essentially he'd self-immolated. So it was kind of an abrupt ending to what had been a very long career. He was 69 when he died. He'd become a monk when he was 19. So half a century he'd been involved as a Buddhist monk.
A 50-year career, as you described there, but he became a very controversial figure, didn't he, because of some of the activities associated with the sect that he was in charge of.
A very controversial figure. He was in charge of the Choge sect for about 8 years up until 2017. And during that period, there was a whole string of controversies. A video came out which appeared to show monks smoking, drinking and gambling. There were also suggestions of embezzling money from the order and other things as well. Perhaps more seriously, monks take a vow of celibacy, but there were suggestions that some of them had married and fathered children. Also, when he stepped down, there were accusations that he tried to maintain his own power and influence by choosing his successor. So certainly he was a great spiritual character and respected for that. There was a more worldly side to him, which a lot of people didn't think reflected well on his character.
Mickey Bristow. The Croatian capital, Zagreb, has introduced drive-in tests for whooping cough after the country suffered a surge in the number of cases. The increase has been blamed partly on disinformation and anti-vaxxers. Guy Delaney has more.
It's the most serious outbreak of whooping cough the Croatia's seen for more than 40 years. A normal year brings about 50 cases of the disease. This year, there have been 1,300 already. That's prompted a rush of people to testing centres. Queues grew too long in the capital Zagreb, so now there's a drive-in centre with in-car tests similar to the COVID pandemic. Health authorities hope concerns sparked by the outbreak will reverse a worrying downward trend in vaccination rates. They blame COVID lockdowns and anti-vaccination campaigns for the decline.
Guy Delaney. Now, we're going to end on Russia. That's the sound of the Bolshoi Ballet, one of the most prestigious in the world, performing Swan Lake back in 2015. Vladimir Urin was in charge then, as he remained up until now. But since he signed a petition last year criticising President Putin's invasion of Ukraine, his future has been in doubt. Well, now he's being replaced as the head of the Bolshoi Theatre, one of Russia's most prominent cultural organisations, by Valery Gagiev, a conductor and high-profile supporter of Vladimir Putin. Our regional editor, Paul Moss, told me more.
The strange thing about this story is the man who's had to quit at the Bolshoi had been seen as quite loyal to Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Urin, his name was. He'd supported Russia's invasion of Crimea back in 2014. He admits he actually got rid of playwrights who opposed the invasion, but it seems Mr. Urin has sort of changed his tune because earlier this year he signed a petition calling for all sides in Ukraine to stop fighting. And a lot of people then thought the writing was on the wall for him. We are told he's now resigned of his own accord. Not everyone's convinced. He's been replaced by an ultra-loyalist for the Kremlin, Valery Gagiev, who's always supported the policies of Vladimir Putin. In fact, he held a concert in honour of Russian military victory. He's already the head of the St. Petersburg Mariinsky Theatre. Now, very unusually, he's going to be in charge of the Bolshoi as well, the two leading drama venues of Russia. It looks like the Kremlin wants to make sure they're both in safe hands.
All right, so he's a man with a lot on his plate now. Would it be fair to say this isn't the first time that something like this has happened?
No, I mean, even before the invasion, a major theatre in Siberia put on a production of the Wagner opera that the authorities didn't approve of. That got the director sacked. In fact, it's happened at the Bolshoi itself. Alexander Molochnikov is a playwright who criticised the war in Ukraine. He had all his productions at the Bolshoi cancelled. Another theatre, the Meyerhold Theatre, had a statement issued criticising the war, and the director of that theatre was sacked. And for anyone with a historical mind, there's a sense of déjà vu here because there was a previous Meyerhold Theatre, and that was closed down during Joseph Stalin's terror.
Now, authoritarian leaders who want to ensure that their kind of influence extends beyond, you know, mainstream politics, not a big surprise, but why in this instance the focus on attacking cultural figures, and in particular those in theatre?
Well, one thing is that theatres in Russia are actually controlled by the government. This is a hangover from the Soviet era. It's the culture ministry that decides who's hired, who's fired, what the budgets are, so easy for them to control. Theatre is also big in Russia. I mean, you know, they're fiercely proud of their writers like Chekhov. I should say this cuts both ways. Valery Gagiev, who's just taken over at the Bolshoi, he lost his work in Western Europe. Lots of theatres cancelled him when he refused to denounce the invasion. We've seen plenty of countries drop works by Russians in general. I mean, in one case, we've had people dropping Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, a decision that was controversial.
Paul Moss on the Bolshoi. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, as always. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van with a sweet solar-powered kitchenette and space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC. Ambitions made real.